would, via the flume. There would have been early sedimentation from the logging, including effects from the splash damming, which was construction of a dam where water would be impounded, trees would be brought in behind it, and then those would have been rapidly removed to move the timber down towards the mill, as well as a lot of oxen teams were used to drag those big trees down water courses and get them to the river so they could get to the mill. A lot of the riparian trees, those were the first to go, the big old growth trees that kept the river cool. Those were the easiest to get. Those are the first ones I would have taken. You got to get them as close as you can when it's this primitive of a logging operation. And subsequently, a lot of the area that was harvested was intentionally converted to provide grassland for grazing. There was extensive grazing also, an effort to change the land from timber to a grazing kind of situation. I find this really interesting. These are some old historic counts from the old timers that used to be in the area that grew up out there in the Garcia. I want to read a couple of these. The river was different in those days. There was no quiet water anywhere. You could always hear it running. The riffles were steeper and it was cleaner. The river fell out into the ocean. The river was beautiful and clean, very natural. The river was full of fish, trout, and every riffle. Up on the South Fork, those creeks were so full of fish, you couldn't believe it. Every little riffle, every place there was a hole, there was fish spawning. And some early fish tales. The fishing was unbelievable. I can remember when we were jack-lighting, the water was so deep you couldn't see all the fish down there, so we spear blind. It wasn't unusual to get two fish at a time, go through one fish and get another. In old times, it was nothing to see 60 or more Chinook, all three or more feet long in this hole at one time. There were a lot of 35 to 40 pound Chinook, but nothing like the numbers of coho. In late November, the steelhead would start coming in, and their runs would last until April when the spring run of bluebacks came. Kind of gives you a feel for what the condition was. Even after that early logging, things were really still pretty robust. A lot of that is probably attributed to the conditions on the interior of the watershed. It was generally inaccessible at that point to early logging, and it was dominated by late cereal forests, old growth trees, and it was largely untouched until around the 1950s. There were some parts of the watershed that were retained. This is a really unique part on the Maillard Ranch called the Cathedral Grove. It's a 60-acre preserved stand that the family has retained since they first took ownership. This is what it would have looked like. I gathered these photos from the California Geologic Survey. These are old aerial photos. This is from 1952. And this is along the main stem of the Garcia, where it comes down and meets the South Fork. Just looking at it, it's really virtually untouched. I can see a little bit of what appears to be a road right here. And it's possible that some of the trees along this lower main stem part would have been taken during the early logging. But then as you move forward or up the watershed, you can see the canopy is even tighter. It's pretty pristine at that point. That changed dramatically after World War II. In the 1950s and 1960s, there was a very large boom, a housing boom that demanded a lot of wood products. And so the North Coast at that point really started to experience a lot of the heavy industrial logging. There was improved heavy equipment to access the interior that allowed for construction of roads and skid trails. The river no longer was the necessary means of getting wood to the market. Rather, we could use tractors and load them on the trucks and put them on the highways and get them out. And at that point, there were no environmental regulations really protecting the watersheds. One of the first or more significant mills was the Hollow Tree Lumber Company's Mill B site. It was right in the middle of the watershed. Here on the top left, you can see construction across this log stringer bridge. This was November of 1962. And there was a large area where the mill was actually being constructed. This is a teepee burner, and for scale, there's a tractor right next to it. And oh, man, this is a large teepee burner. And then a bunch of housing for the workers that would be there. And you can see before the mill was even completed, there's trees being logged or stacked on the deck for processing. I'm gonna take you back to the former picture. Right here is this shape, kind of looks like the eagle head or something like that. I want to just orient you to that location. Right down here is where the South Fork comes in, and this is the main stem of the Garcia. I showed you this photo before from 1952, and then by 1963 you can see the extent of the industrial logging that had begun. It's pretty incredible that you can go from a pristine forest to 11 years later being in a condition like this. There was quite a bit of logging all over. And like I said, there were no rules at that point. I want to take you to one more location. Right here, it looks kind of like a profile of a face. Signal Creek comes in down at the bottom, and Inman Creek comes in at the top. Again, this is 1952. Signal Creek would have been in here somewhere. I think you can kind of get a feel for the outline. Here's the profile of the face. And then Inman Creek is up in the top. And there's 1963. Again, it's just amazing how many roads and skid trails, ground-based equipment moved in to remove all this timber. There's mainline road that comes all the way down along the bottom. And then you can actually see right here that teepee burner burning. This is August of 1963. This is 9 months. This is
see the smoke plume.
You can see the smoke plume coming off of it. Again, Signal Creek is down here at the bottom, and it's at the top.
That's lovely.
Here is a Signal Creek 1955 photograph from the California Department of Fish and Game. This road was constructed right up one of the channels in Signal Creek. You can see that the stream has been pushed to the side, and the amount of erosion and sediment moving off of situations like this would be overwhelming for the system indeed. And the amount of slash that was brought in and pushed all over left in stream channels. Just for scale, you can see this man at the very top of this photograph walking across it. In the 80s and 90s, there was a renewed wave of logging. Approximately 43% of the watershed was logged again. You can see that some of the methods might have changed at that point. This, to me, appears to be like a mid-slope road with cable yarding below it, but there's still a lot of ground-based activities. There's other land uses that have been contributing over this period to the problems that we were experiencing in the Garcia. Agricultural activities, as I spoke before, the early conversion, intentional conversion of forests for grazing. There was grazing regularly within the river and its tributaries. Crop production was right up to the banks of the river, and there is still crop production taking place. Water diversion was regularly taking place from the river itself. Also, gravel mining went for approximately 30 years. They were extracting approximately 67,000 tons per year out of the Garcia. And the in-stream effects are summarized by this Fish and Game report from 1966. They found that 37 of 104 miles were classified as severely damaged with no streamside canopy, no in-stream shelter or pools, as well as 75 to 100% siltation of the gravel substrate. In addition to this, the temperatures were very elevated. All of those riparian trees were removed. The channel would have been very simplified. Large wood would have been removed. Habitat would have been really badly impaired. Made it not very suitable for salmonids. So where are we with them? How'd they respond to that? At this point, the Chinook salmon no longer have a viable population in the Garcia. Occasionally, they are found. They will come up and be caught by anglers, but they do not have a run. Coho salmon, back in 1960, 50, Fish and Game were estimated that around 2,000 coho were spawning in the Garcia annually. Currently, in the entire Central Coast ESU of coho salmon, there's an estimate of 500 to 3,000. So you can see a major decline across the whole region, the whole ESU. Right now, they're state-listed as endangered, and they're highly vulnerable to extinction within the next 50 years. Very serious. We're right on the edge of losing this ESU of coho. Pink salmon, although they were historically always found in low abundance in California, it's interesting that they have a known presence in the Garcia and Redwood Creek up near Oric. In 2003, 23 spawning pair of pinks were found in the lower Garcia. And they have a weird life cycle. It's a two-year life cycle. Right now they're coming back on odd years. So we could expect, if they do come back, that they'd probably be coming back in 2009 again. They are already considered wiped out in California. They don't even exist in Oregon. Up in Alaska, there's a very robust population, but there's some stragglers hanging on down here. I think it's fascinating that they're in the Garcia, too. Pretty exciting. Steelhead trout are our most viable population in the Garcia at this time. There's estimates that approximately 1,000 steelhead are spawning in the Garcia every year, which is about a quarter of what it might have been in 1960. But they are listed as threatened, and this is for the Northern California coast winter steelhead. So they have a low risk of extinction within the next 50 to 100 years. Things have changed over time. There has been an ongoing modernization of the timber harvest activities and practices. We have protection zones now for watercourses, whereas we didn't at all before. There's improved sediment control standards that have been brought up in regular timber operations, and there's alternative yarding and silvicultural practices from what it was back in the 50s and 60s. The agricultural standards have also greatly increased. We have riparian fencing is being installed in a lot of areas, animal waste management, and crop setbacks. The commercial gravel mining has stopped in the Garcia. And there's been quite a lot of restoration that has been done on a lot of the segments of the river. Later on, one of our guest speakers will be talking about his work that he's been doing in the Garcia for 20 years, working on river restoration. There's been new rules and listings that took place over that time. Clean Water Act was adopted in 1972. The Forest Practice Act and rules came in the mid-70s. The Garcia was listed as impaired on Section 303D of the Clean Water Act for excessive sediment and elevated temperatures in 1993, the threatened and impaired rules were produced by the Forest Practice rules. And then in 2002, the Garcia River Watershed Sediment TMDL was adopted into the Basin Plan. The National Marine Fisheries Service summarized some key priority recovery actions that would help to recover or move towards recovery of the Garcia. That includes the reduction of sediment loading from both past activities, the legacy sources, as well as some of the current sources, improving the shade canopy to reduce the temperatures. There's certain sections along the main stem, especially, where the temperatures are still too hot. Increasing the large woody debris in the system to provide more habitat complexity. and removing barriers to fish migration. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Garcia TMDL now. It gets at a number of those priority recovery actions. There's three compliance options provided in the Garcia TMDL. Option one is to comply with the waste discharge prohibitions. This is the default option that applies to everybody initially. Option two and option three require development of an erosion control plan and either a site-specific management plan or to follow the Garcia River Management Plan measures. Those are a series of best management practices that are already included within the Garcia TMDL Action Plan. And these are the waste discharge prohibitions. They're a stringent prohibition, basically a no-controllable discharge standard. Under option two and option three, you are required to develop an erosion control plan, which consists of four parts. The first part being an inventory of controllable sediment delivery sites. Those are sites that have the potential to deliver 10 cubic yards or greater to a water course over the course of the TMDL, which is 40 years. Part two is a development of a sediment reduction schedule. It's an implementation schedule for those inventories. Part three is an assessment of unstable areas and landslides. And the fourth part is an effectiveness monitoring and reporting program that landowners who are moving forward with addressing their sediment sources report on an annual basis on the work that has been done during the prior year. Here's a couple photos showing some of the sites that we visit regularly. Here's an old logging road that was just left in place that has some significant failures of the outboard fill prism. And this site and several miles of this road were put to bed last year under a grant from the Fish and Game on the Conservation Fund's property. And the second part of the option two and option three is to develop a land management plan. That's essentially those BMPs on how you're going to prevent the creation of new sediment sources associated with your land management activities. Here's a map showing the current coverage of landowners we are working with in the watershed. So these are people, landowners that we've been involved with since adoption of the TMDL throughout the watershed. There's all the colored areas are different ownerships that we're working with. Later on today, you're going to hear from Larry Myard a little bit about some of the work they've been doing up near the headwaters in Partelow and Mill Creek. You're also going to hear some of the work that the Conservation Fund has been doing on their property, including an inventory and implementation of erosion control in Inman Creek, as well as some wood projects that they're working on. Mendocino Redwood Company is going to speak a bit about the work that they've been doing on their property, including in the South Fork of the Garcia. And then at the end, Craig Bell will be speaking a bit about some of the restoration work he's been doing along the main stem. So what else are we doing? Quite a bit. I regularly participate in the timber harvest planning review process. I work closely with foresters and the CAL FIRE to ensure that timber harvest projects are being conducted in a way that's consistent with the forest practice rules and the TMDL implementation plan. I conduct numerous pre-harvest, active, and completion inspections on projects. And this year I actually also participated in a fire response as part of the State Emergency Action Team. I was out with the CAL FIRE looking at some of their work to control sediment on an area in the watershed that burned. Approximately 1% of the watershed burned this year during the Mendocino Fire Complex. There has been some enforcement activities that we've been participating in. There was a cleanup and abatement issue. Cleanup and abatement order issued in 2007. There was a notice of violation just recently issued in October, and there's been a couple notices of violation for THPs and NTMPs that were being implemented without certifying coverage under our waiver. We have a number of grants that we're also implementing. I'm currently the grant manager for the Fish Rock Road Sediment Reduction Project with the Mendocino County Department of Transportation. It's a $787,000 grant to address controllable erosion along Fish Rock Road, 14.4-mile segment of road. Another grant that another staff person, Kathleen Bailey, in our office is a manager for, and will probably be discussed again later, is the Garcia River Bank Stabilization Project. This is a series of photos of a project that was done, a bioengineering project and a workshop. This is an area kind of on the lower main stem of the Garcia. This was several hundred yards of eroding stream bank along the river. There was an incorporation of some hardened material and then a lot of willow planting. This is just photos taken from October of the same bank as up here. These are now 20 feet tall. It was a successful project. Craig Bell was involved in this, and Evan Engmar from Bioengineering Associates. I got to participate in this too. I got to learn a lot about construction of willow mattresses and actually installing those. So it's neat to be able to go out and see how these things are moving forward.
Did Evan let you pound stakes?
He did let me.
He's a good man.
He's generous with the sledgehammer, and he put you to work. Our staff also have been collaborating with the Nature Conservancy on a Garcia River in-stream monitoring effort. In 2007, we began a monitoring program in the property known as the Garcia River Forest. And in 2008, I managed a team of our staff to go out and conduct monitoring on other properties within the watershed that included near the headwaters on the Maillard Ranch, as well as down on the Storneta public lands and adjacent to the Walter Storneta's property down near the bottom of the river. The effort is being conducted based on the methods of the EPA's Environmental Monitoring and Assessment Program and the state's Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. They're very similar. They overlap in a lot of ways. We're collecting a lot of different information about the physical habitat characterization, channel dimensions, hallway profile, substrate size. We're also looking at stream discharge measurements, biological measurements, including large woody debris tallies, benthic macroinvertebrate collection, vegetation structure, and we're also calculating the current ambient water quality parameters. Part of this, at the end of our monitoring, you also do an aquatic vertebrate monitoring, which is an actual snorkel survey in the stream. We have a yellow-legged frog up here. These are either some California newts or rough-skin newts, three of them on top. And then this is a western pond turtle, and that's me. I don't count in the tally. We did have some very encouraging finds this year. The Nature Conservancy did extensive surveying, snorkel surveys on a number of different reaches within their property, and they found 9 different reaches had coho in them. We also found one up on the Partolo Creek, which is within the Maillard Ranch. This is actually the photo taken when Jennifer Kara and I were snorkeling and found these are coho up in front. These are 4 different coho, and then in the back is a steelhead. That's a steelhead. It's a pretty challenging when you're in a stream and there's steelhead everywhere also, and then you don't expect to see coho out there, and then suddenly, Jennifer pointed these out to me. I was just looking at them, counting them like they were steelhead. I was being trained at the time. Luckily, there's somebody there that could train me appropriately. The difference between these, you can see there's some long, the par marks, are they look like kind of paint drips that extend down the sides. This anal fin is more kind of sickle-shaped, and they have kind of a softer hue to them, I've noticed. So here's a map showing where coho were found. All these yellow sites were within the Conservation Fund's property, and then this is the site that was found up on the Myard Ranch. This is a significant site because the previously known extent of coho in the watershed was up to Inman Creek. So this extended the range 11 miles up into the almost the headwaters of the Garcia. It's pretty amazing. There have been a lot of surveys done over the last several decades, including in Bartolome. They had not been found there before. So I wanted to briefly touch on some of our objectives for this monitoring. We collect all this information. We want to identify what the current conditions are, compare that to what the TMDL numeric targets are, expand our coverage by trying to get out onto other properties so we have a better feel for the watershed as a whole, and conduct some resampling, probably around every 5 years, if possible, funding willing. And eventually, as conditions improve, hopefully we will be delisting some of these sub-watersheds. Jennifer Kara from the Nature Conservancy will be touching a bit more on this monitoring during her presentation. She goes into a little bit greater detail on some of the specifics of it. So next steps. We plan on continuing our outreach to other ownerships that we're not currently working with. There's a lot of landowners out there. We're working with a lot. There's a lot more to do. We're going to continue to build upon the partnerships we have with the different agencies, landowners, and stakeholders. I want to continue seeking out new sources of grant funding to assist some of these efforts to control sediment. A lot of these landowners deserve some assistance whenever possible to address some of these sources. So whenever possible, I try to share that information with them when grants may be available that they can apply for, try to coordinate that a little bit. We want to continue collecting and analyzing the monitoring data to get a better feel for what the conditions are. Like I said, continue to expand the monitoring program and support other monitoring efforts that are being conducted in the watershed to better understand it. I want to thank all the different parties that are involved in the Garcia. There's been an effort that extends back over numerous decades and through numerous generations and families. It's important to note that a lot of people have been putting a lot of energy and time into restoring this watershed, so it needs to be recognized. And I want to thank my crew who have been out there under my whip monitoring on the Garcia. So that wraps up my presentation. If you have any questions, I'm happy to try and answer them. Otherwise, I'd like to turn it over to our first invited guest speaker. Would be Larry Meyer.
Chair's preference is to move on to the speakers unless board members have questions and need clarification at this point. So, all right. Thank you. Very thorough, John. Appreciate it. Yeah. We do have extensive list of speakers, but we'll get at it. Larry Mallard. And, is Todd joining you, or is it sequential, or we don't have Todd today?
We don't have Todd today. That's
very good. And if I may, just before Larry begins, I repeat again, anyone here for the great night, and we're going to take that up after lunch, 1 o'clock. Do we have anybody from Ferndale here? Okay.
Yeah, I saw someone here earlier.
Yeah, they may.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, fellow board members. I see a few familiar faces up there. It's been quite a while since I've been in this chair. But no matter how many times, I still get nervous, so bear with me. I thought I would start. My name is Larry Meyard, representing the Meyard Ranch, which you've seen on Jonathan's screen. We own about 8,000 acres of the headwaters of the Garcia watershed in Mill Creek and Fertile Oak Creek. And I thought I'd give you a short history of the family ranch. My grandfather, my grandmother went up there in 1916 and deer hunting. That was their love. He got them into that country and they bought the first piece in 1925. Since then, there's been 38 different acquisitions to put it together. And, it's quite a property. The sort of the land use history was, again, they started purchasing the property with hunting in mind. And a lot of the property they bought just the land. They did not have the timber rights on it. After grandfather saw what was starting to happen, he went back and subsequently did purchase those timber rights so that he would have control over the property. We did not start any logging activities until 1958, at least that's the best I can record. And it was just the web of the land. And my grandfather died in 1954, and actually he died before he gave a gift to the state of the Redwood League of 220 acres because it was his favorite grove and he wanted to protect it. Subsequently, it was turned over to the state to be made a park. And after his passing, grandmother petitioned to have it made into a reserve so that there wasn't camping and the same privileges that a park had to the public, and that was granted. But it's totally surrounded by the remaining property of the ranch. I started working on the ranch when I was 12, and worked there until I was in my early 20s, ranching and also logging. Went away to college, got a real job, but in 1984, my uncle, in his fading health, made me a general partner. In 1988, I moved back to the ranch and became the managing general partner. And so I was basically asked by Jonathan to discuss the ranch's involvement with the TMDL process. Well, my memory serves me best that in the mid-90s, the workshops started. Discussing the TMDL, meetings out on the coast in Point Arena and Manchester. And I wasn't sure why I was going, except for I was there representing the ranch and finding out what was going on. Well, then the process got more defined and more defined, and it got down to the development of three steps. You had the voluntary option, secondary, and the third. Well, being a new regulation handed down, and that was going to affect us, there was no way of getting around it, the involvement became more and more. The ranch had originally signed up as a voluntary participant. And when we did that, we found out that voluntary aspect didn't exist. You had to pick a form of management. And we opted for the option two. And we were one of the forerunners in our neck of the woods because the ranch has always supported itself by logging. It has been that way since the beginning. My grandfather understood that the logging was necessary. My grandmother hated it, didn't want to see it. So if she told her three boys, my dad and my two uncles, that if you're going to log, I just don't want to see it. So the roads that she used were usually along the riparian corridors, so those were not touched, and not touched for a good enough buffer that she, traveling her property, would not see any of the results of it, which sort of came back and bit us later. But because part of the development of the TMDL was a restriction on harvesting along wilt pizzas. And in the TMDL, you have to leave the five largest trees per 100 lineal feet of stream. 100 feet's not that long. So if you start taking the five largest trees out of that inventory, for this property and for our method of harvesting, it was a huge amount. In the earlier process, I was asked to try to figure a cost on what this extraction of resource was. And in early 2000, I think it was 2002, 2003, we came up with about a $12 million confiscation. And that was what my Uncle George called it. It was a confiscation to regulation. But that's basically spilled milk. The TMDL process was something, another regulation, on top of the CDF rules and the fish and game rules that we had to live with and incorporate into our management, and we have. We needed to harvest to pay and keep the ranch operating, so we developed our TMDL plan, which included a erosion control plan and a site-specific management plan. And we worked diligently with our executive director and staff here and created one that you accepted, we accepted, and it's actually quite a document. I'm proud of it for my team that put it together and one that your team accepted. We originally started implementing the TMDL through our harvest plans only. And so that was built into the cost of creating the harvest plan. I can't break out what the percentage was or not, but it was a significant additional cost that comes out of the trees. We have subsequently created a ECP and SSMP for the balance of the ownership in the Garcia. And that has turned into quite a project also. We've covered about approximately 40 miles of road and an additional 239 sites that we've established, created, designed a method of improvement or a change if it's appropriate. And a timetable to do these implementations. We've GPSed all the roads, GPSed all the sites. We will, in the process of actively permanently monitoring and labeling those sites in the field. And the schedule to do that is what's already started, but it's going to take several years to get it completed, but it's going to be an ongoing project. One of the relative facts to this was is the cost of this, what it's cost to the ranch. We have currently spent, and let me finish this, the approximately $250,000 since 2003 in both creating the site-specific management plan and the ECP. But the important thing is here, we've been able to, part of the revenue has come from the timber harvesting, but part of it has come from Department of Fish and Game grants, and we're currently applying for an EQIP grant to make this possible, because the ranch would not have that kind of money to put into the back into the land if it wasn't for these grants. They're very pivotal, and they've been helpful. Hopefully with a farm bill plan, we can get this EQIP thing and get that going. But we look that we've eyeballed this next project to bring the rest of the ranch into compliance, and We are looking probably at between $200,000 and $225,000. Again, hopefully this can be covered with a grant. The equipped grant which we're applying for is, it was pointed out to me that this is not a cost share program so much as an incentive program, because it doesn't necessarily cover all your costs, but it certainly makes it more palatable to be able to have that kind of funding available. Jonathan Warmerdam has been sort of pecking at me to try to get me to bring the balance of the ranch, the other 7,000 acres of the ranch, which lies in the Navarro watershed, to bring that under the same TMDL. And I am not going to agree to the Garcia TMDL in the Navarro watershed, but what Jonathan has not had a chance to see, but he will, is we have been systematically over the last 4 or 5 years, when we're in harvesting, when we're doing our normal ranch road work and what have you, basically voluntarily bringing it up to the standards that the TMDL requires. And it's just simple. If you're going to do it once, do it right. And when they come out and look at it, I think they'll be very, very pleased with how it is, how it's developing. And I know I've been a little bit negative here about all the restrictions and the extra, costs and what have you, but the thing that's made this whole TMDL process the most palatable for me in the last 15 years is working with your staff here at Water Quality. And they have bent over backwards, I believe, to make it work. They've extended deadlines for us, which when you come up with a program, you put deadlines in there. They seem attainable, but they're really not when you're working on the land. And Catherine has been great, and Jonathan has been great, accepting our ECP and SMP, and giving us the time frame, the realistic time frame to do these projects. We're going to get it done. Funding, being made available. But they need some kudos in that it's really made it palatable. It's made it workable, and it will into the future. I've been lucky, or I consider myself lucky, in being able to work with Jonathan, and that it either hasn't gone up the ladder or sideways on the ladder. The fact that I've been able to deal with one person over this duration of time has been very helpful, because in other agencies, when you're dealing with a new person every year and we have to train them, it gets tough. So instead of worrying and complaining and getting scared about having Water Quality come on the ranch now, it's one that we meet with regularity and with a positive attitude, and that has made it work. My grandfather gave me a heck of a playground to manage. I'm doing my best. There is something that I look at the ranch as my legacy, is that we are trying to put an easement on the ranch, conservation easement, and we are making good headway with that to get rid of the 82 parcels that we own, the CCs. We don't want to see it broken up. It's partly an estate management plan, but it's most really what is happening on the land and my aspect of it. It's making the ranch a much better, safer, cleaner place, and I think the fish will come back. I want to see the fish back. I want to see the biodiversity throughout the whole property. And that's what I have to say, and I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, you're getting, as I think, kudos for your performance, and I think you should get kudos for your efforts out there. I do appreciate it. Any board members want to follow up? All right, we're going to go on. Chris Kelly, Evan Smith, Conservation Fund. And Jennifer, you're welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Anderson, members of the board, and staff. I'm Chris Kelly, California Program Director for the Conservation Fund. We're a national nonprofit land conservation organization, and we're going to talk to you today about our work on the Garcia River Forest, about 24,000 acres that lies in the middle of the watershed, and which is pictured here on the screen. I first want to echo Mr. Maillard's sentiments about working with the regional board staff. We bought the property in 2004 and immediately had to embark on a comprehensive planning process, and both Director Kuhlman, or Executive Officer Kuhlman, and Jonathan and the staff have been instrumental in helping us develop a plan that incorporates natural diversity preservation, sustainable timber management, and water quality enhancement. We'll be talking to you about that in our presentation this morning, but I just want to echo those sentiments. I have shortened my presentation to move things along, but let me explain. Why does a nonprofit organization that's interested in land preservation own a forest? And our primary motivation was to prevent what you see here, which is really the culmination of the centuries, decades long management, initially for timber, and now with the timber depleted in the near term, what we see increasingly is the conversion of these large parcels to smaller rural ranches and vineyard. And I don't need to tell you the consequences of that kind of extensive conversion on water quality, natural diversity, and ultimately the extinction of the timber industry. I mean, you won't get these forests back in any productive capacity if you wind up subdividing it into smaller and smaller pieces. So we also understood that given the size of the conservation challenge, the 24,000 acres is an immense property to conserve, it seemed impractical to try to buy it and put it into public ownership and make it a park. It's impractical because you don't have any revenue for management. It also has a local fiscal impact on the tax base, and it further diminishes the opportunity for productive employment in the woods. So we thought we would try a different approach, which we're calling working forest conservation. And the idea is to keep the property on the tax rolls, allow sustainable timber management in ways that pay for maintenance, pay for restoration, and keep people working in the woods. And also we carry the burden of the stewardship of the property and the cost of restoration. So we think this is an innovative and we hope replicable approach to forest conservation. We've been fortunate in getting financial support from the Wildlife Conservation Board, the State Coastal Conservancy, and most importantly, we've enjoyed a wonderful partnership with the Nature Conservancy, which holds a conservation easement on the property, and as you'll hear in a moment, has done extensive water quality or rather aquatic habitat assessment and monitoring. One of the things I want to stress is that we have made efforts to outreach to the community, to involve them in our planning for the forest. We run dozens and dozens of tours and took comment and input from community members, and that was all folded into a integrated resource management plan, which was approved by our funders in August of 2006 and now provides the basis for the management of the property. I'm now going to introduce Evelyn Smith, who is the Conservation Fund's Director of Forestry, who has been managing all aspects of operations of the forest, and as well as designing the silvicultural and other management measures. So with that, I'll turn this over to Evelyn.
Thank you, Evelyn. Chris briefly mentioned that we have a forest management plan, and we're relative newcomers to this watershed, you know, having just acquired property here in 2004 and not having much history with forest management operations in California prior to that. And one of our big challenges is taking the concepts that are part of the forest management plan and putting them into specific policies, which you can sort of see here, is these are kind of general guidelines and objectives of how we're trying to do uneven aged forestry, and we're trying to provide revenue to support other restoration and conservation projects, and we're trying to make sure that we're retaining wildlife habitat and accelerating some of the late Cheryl stand development that we need. But the bigger challenge is taking those policies and putting them in practice in the woods. And what you see here is something that's increasingly common on our properties, which is a lot of guys standing around trying to figure out what to do. And this is one of the many sort of tours that we put on, and this happens to be one that we do before every timber harvest plan. We have an internal work group go out in the field and discuss this across a broad spectrum of interests. And then we also have a public community tour, usually before and then after each timber harvest, so we can get input, see how people react to what was done, get feedback, etc. And I just kind of, this is actually on our Big River property, but the elements are the same. That's Mike Stevens, who's our wildlife biologist. He's a consultant. He's in that sort of top right corner. Linda Perkins, who's the head of the Sierra Club chapter, it's myself and Chris Kelly. Craig Blanco, with the Blue Hats, a consulting forester who's been active in Mendocino County for 30 plus years. Lee Susan, another consulting forester. And Bill Lemos, who's the, at that time was the head of the Sonar Natural Resources Program at the Mendocino High School. And I want to sort of cover that just because it's a great perspective of the type of input that we try and get, and we've been very fortunate to have this sort of engagement from the broad community. Very briefly, sort of the process that happens after we figure out from standing around in the woods what to do. All of our timber harvests to date, there's been two that have been completed on the Garcia River Forest. There's two more that are approved that will be harvested this coming summer of 2009. They've all been individual marked timber harvests, so foresters are out marking the trees with blue paint, which the loggers then fall. That's your one of our licensed timber operators, Rick Hodala, the bottom left. Trees get loaded, sent on to some of the local mills. We sell to, I want to say, six mills in the Mendocino and Humboldt area. The timber harvest proceeds should be on the neighborhood of somewhere around $500,000 a year for us, based on our annual allowable cut for the next two decades. And that goes to cover the fairly considerable expenses associated with managing this property, everything from property taxes and fire protection, as well as some of the restoration costs. And I want to kind of emphasize the importance of our timber harvest program, because it's what allows us to do all of kind of what, as a conservation group, we consider sort of cool stuff. All of the ecological monitoring, the really interesting restoration projects that we have underway, they're all sort of supported by the ability to harvest timber. And our board asks me all the time, you know, what's going to go wrong? And I sort of say, all right, you know, what's the worst case scenario? You know, this was a big risky initiative for us. We weren't sort of set up to do this. It was a first-time project. They say, what can go wrong? And, you know, most of the time, if you talk to somebody in the forestry community about what can go wrong, you know, the sort of first thing that they look at is some sort of environmental issue. And, you know, this is my chance to pick on Jen about having her little picture on the San Francisco Chronicle. But really, this is the least of our worries. This is really exciting. You know, the fact that they found these new stretch of coho spawning on the Myron Ranch is really great. So if it's not the kind of science side of environment that we're worried about, the other thing that people get really worried about are the environmental activists and how they're going to stop all the timber harvests that occur in this county. And that's actually most of the environmental activist community of coastal Mendocino County. They were out on our property last weekend helping us pull pampas grass, which is an invasive weed. So we've worked hard to have very strong, open relationships with the environmental community. And you know, feel like we have a good, productive relationship there. So if that's not the worry, maybe this is, should be the worry. This is one of the stands after the Mendocino Lightning Complex fire went through it. And you can see there's pretty extensive damage to both the forest as well as the watershed conditions. But that's a relatively small factor, both spatially as well as temporally. It's a natural system. And the slope right there is actually pretty green right now, only 5 months later. So the big thing that keeps me up at night and that I worry about is probably not something that you would expect to hear from an environmental group, but it's really the decline of our sort of working forest infrastructure and the mills. And, you know, these are the things that, you know, we worry about and we pay attention to, because we lose this sort of infrastructure, we lose our ability to do these kind of projects. So I want to switch from what was hopefully not too negative, but talk about from our forestry to talk about our roads. And this is a picture that I always smile when I see it. I have it loaded on my computer. And it's probably not something that too many other people appreciate, but if there's ever an audience that's going to appreciate it, it's in this room. And it was actually Craig Bell who first taught me the beauty that is in this picture. And that is a picture of a very, very well-executed outsloped and rolling dip road. It's a very hard thing to take a picture of, and it doesn't look very exciting until you realize just how much work goes into taking. We have 200-some miles of roads across our properties, and converting them from how they were constructed into how we would like to see them constructed. Here's an example of you know, a typical culvert up on the top left, sort of short, placed wrong, typical kind of shotgun approach. And then after a sort of total reconstruction, pulled up that whole sort of road prism, put a new culvert that's the right diameter and the right length and in the right place and armored in the right way. And, you know, that's that exact same spot a couple years later. So we're doing a lot of that. Sometimes they're bigger pipes. We spent, I want to say, $110,000 on culverts last year. And that's just for a very small portion of our property. Want to spend a little bit of time talking about this map to get you oriented to what's going on. That's our Garcia River Forest in green. The Mendocino Redwood Company holdings would be to the southeast, to the southwest, and the Myriad Ranch to the east. We have received cost share funding through Department of Fish and Game to complete watershed assessments across the entire property. That's 24,000 acres, more or less 200 miles. It started with Signal and Inman Creek because those were sort of seen as some of the highest priority from a fish protection standpoint. And Jonathan mentioned those already. That's been completed. The rest of the property, the watershed assessment is underway and should be completed hopefully by the end of this year, but more realistically sometime early next year. And those are what form the basis of our erosion control plans that are part of our option 2 compliance under the TMDL. In addition to those assessments, we've also, you can see, these individual timber harvests are the ones that are sort of colored in here. And as part of each timber harvest, they have their own separate road assessment that then becomes a separate ECP for TMDL compliance. In addition to the assessment work, we have a number of road upgrading and decommissioning projects underway, the first of which is in this Inman drainage, and the red roads that are shown there were selected as the highest priority for upgrading and decommissioning, the whole sort of process of putting in those beautiful rolling dips and replacing culverts. And that has been completed. We have been approved. That was also done under a Fish and Game cost share grant. We've been approved for a similar project on Signal Creek, again treating some of the highest priority roads within that subwatershed. All of the roads within the timber harvest plan area we've committed to fix, and probably about two-thirds of those were already completed. The rest will be done next summer. And that accounts for about 20% of the roads so far. We just received, through a mitigation settlement with Pulte Homes, funding to complete road upgrades and decommissioning on the balance of the North Fork, this watershed here, and Blue Water Hole Creek, which is part of the Victoria Fork Watershed Assessment Unit. So we have a lot going on. It's occurring in phases, and we've been, you know, really happy with Jonathan's support through this whole process of kind of helping us figure out everything that needs to get done. But it's a fairly challenging undertaking. Wanted to touch briefly on some of the lessons that we've learned in our 4 years as an owner and operator of timberland in California. The first lesson, and I forgot to put it on here, but I'm reminded of it every time, you know, we start talking about this, is that the Garcia River is just a really wonderful river. And we're really fortunate to, you know, have kind of the be able to purchase this property, and the more that we learn about it, the more that we learn about from all the people that have been working on it for decades, you know, the more excited we are about the future of the river. I'd say that there's a, you know, real challenge, and Mr. Meyer alluded to this, of kind of managing the alphabet soup, and, you know, the erosion control plans, site-specific management plans, and how to integrate them with what was going on before under the sort of timber harvest plan process, and, you know, frankly, figuring out what all the different agencies need and when. It's been a pretty challenging undertaking. I wouldn't say that we've gotten it figured out yet, but I definitely think we're getting better at it. We've got a little over $2 million already committed to road assessment and restoration projects, and we've only completed 20% of the road upgrades at this point. So I want to give you, you know, part of that $2.2 million is to get us up to maybe a third, maybe 40% of our road system. But this is a very significant financial undertaking.
Evan, just clarification, when you say 20%, have you used 20% of $2.2 million, or have you done 20% of what needs to be done?
We've treated 39 of the 200 and change miles of road. We've completed all of our assessment work. The data is still being kind of smoothed out and reports generated. So we finished the watershed assessment. We finished 20% of the road upgrading and decommissioning. And between those two projects, that accounted for about $1 million of that $2.2 million. We've got another $1.2 million between the EPA multi-home settlement and then the road upgrade work for Signal Creek that we're already sort of got the cost share for. So and that's what kind of covers the balance and would get us up probably about 40% of our work to date. The other thing I wanted to sort of mention is that doing this work, both on the assessment side as well as on all this road decommissioning and upgrading, is both an art and a science, and we're still learning. You know, fortunately, we have a lot of people, good people to learn from, but it really does require a lot of flexibility in the field, and that's sometimes hard to do within a regulatory construct. Jonathan's been great to work with, but it's definitely a challenge. The other thing that it really requires is good science going in, and that's sort of trying to tee up what Jen's going to talk about the watershed monitoring, and that's critically important for us both in terms of figuring out what to do as well as figuring out whether or not what we did was helpful and effective. And it also requires having really skilled equipment operators. And, you know, we've got a great crew of people in the Garcia Basin, but it's something that I do also worry about losing. And that was all I wanted to cover, and turn that over to Jen.
I'm Jennifer Kara. I'm a field scientist with the Nature Conservancy's North Coast Program. And I'll try to make it brief. I know we're running out of time. Chris and Evan both touched on some of the kind of main management objectives on the property related to silviculture and road treatment and restoration. And I wanted to just briefly cover one of our primary monitoring objectives for the property, which is to measure progress towards the goal of improving aquatic physical habitat conditions at the Garcia River Forest. And Jonathan covered this earlier, so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but we adopted the EPA's EMAP protocols to do that. They're a set of standardized protocols that have several advantages. They're really statistically robust framework to look at trends in some of these variables over time. We can be part of a national data set. It's compatible with the state water quality measurement protocols. And it's also compatible with the TMDL numeric targets. I'll touch on that again in a minute. I'm not going to go into detail again here. Jonathan covered this, but attributes that we're measuring range everything from channel morphology kinds of things to biological variables such as snorkel surveys for fish, and we do some pretty extensive macro invertebrate collections as well. We began this work in 2007, and I just want to acknowledge the really important role that Jonathan and the Water Board staff played in getting this project off the ground. We really could not have done it without them. They were instrumental in getting this going in the watershed. In 2007, Water Board staff and the Nature Conservancy staff worked together to sample 14 sites using these protocols in the basin. And we started in Inman and Signal Creeks, which are Inman Creek here and Signal Creek here. And then in 2008, the Nature Conservancy hired 6 seasonal employees to sample the remaining 47 additional EMAP sites that lie within the Garcia River Forest boundaries. And in 2008, we were also able to perform snorkel surveys on all 61 of the EMAP sites that lie within the property boundaries. And again, this year we were fortunate to partner with the Water Board staff and snorkeled 8 additional reaches, both on the Meyer Ranch up here and on the Storna Ranch down near the estuary. As Jonathan mentioned, we detected juvenile coho at 10 sites in the watershed this year. There were 3 sites on the main stem of the Garcia, 1 down here and 2 right here, 2 sites on the North Fork, 3 sites on Inman Creek, 1 on Signal Creek, and then 1 on the Myard Ranch up here in Parlow Creek. I wanted to touch briefly on some of the data outputs from the EMAP protocols. And once the raw data have been processed, there are over 150 metrics related to habitat and biology that can be calculated. They fall into 7 categories: channel morphology, substrate, fish cover, and large woody debris, riparian cover and structure, human disturbance. We're calculating approximately 15 metrics related to benthic macroinvertebrate diversity, and as I mentioned, surveying for 7 species of fish and measuring presence absence for a number of herps and some of the larger invertebrates, mussels and crayfish. And we'll use these data for a number of analyses, one of which will be measuring progress towards meeting the Garcia TMDL numeric targets. And of the 11 parameters that were identified in the action plan, EMAP will provide a data stream for 9 of them, an ongoing source of data to evaluate trends in these parameters over time. I highlighted those in red. Beyond the EMAP work, we're also doing some pretty intensive water temperature monitoring in the watershed. And this year, Nature Conservancy partnered with Craig Bell and the Conservation Fund, Oz Farm, BLM, down at the estuary, and the Meyer Ranch in the headwaters to monitor water temperature at 25 places in the watershed. And we had 11 main stem sites where we monitored both air and water temperature, as well as 14 water temperature sites on various tributaries throughout the watershed. And we're fortunate to work with Rich Fadness from the Water Board to borrow some relative humidity meters and able to establish those at west to east gradient across the watershed as well. We'll continue to do the water temperature monitoring on a yearly basis and are just beginning to get into some serious water temperature analysis. Craig and I have been collecting data on the Garcia River Forest property starting in 2006. We also have access to the Friends of the Garcia River data and Mendocino County Resource Conservation data from the 1990s. So we'll be able to look at water temperature trends over time and also start looking at some of the correlated variables, physical and biological variables that correlate with water temperature to try to inform our restoration strategies. We'll continue to do our EMAP sampling and are beginning to work with the EPA to analyze the data that we've collected over the last 2 years to look at relationships between variables, you know, relationships between fish habitat utilization and various physical habitat variables in the system. And I just wanted to mention we're beginning to explore possibilities of conducting saltwater population trend studies in the watershed as well. We've begun conversations with the California Department of Fish and Game to this end. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. All right. Any questions by board members? One to Jennifer, in terms of the 11 items in the TMBO, the 9 which the EMAP covered, are the other two, of course, of a different color and they just weren't related to what EPA, or are they ones that are outliers and they really aren't that important? Or
they're important. Craig Bell, I might talk about this, I'm not sure if he's going to talk about it in his presentation, but he's been doing migration barrier assessments on the property, so that's kind of being taken care of through another avenue. And then as far as the V-Star is concerned, that's not something that's included in the sediment sampling of the EMAP protocols, but I think we feel pretty strongly that we're covering a lot of the sediment stuff with other metrics, but that's something we could potentially pursue. The RCD has done that kind of sampling in the past, so we could look at resampling some of their historic sites.
Mr. Massey, if you were going to respond to that, I'll let you go ahead.
No.
Okay.
I don't know if this is for Jennifer or Jonathan or perhaps even Craig Bell. When there's an enormous leap here from where we've known coho salmon to exist to 11 miles further up the water body, do we know why? I mean, is this the results of recovery, or had they been there in such numbers we couldn't find them? Do we know why this is?
I think there's a number of things going on. One is that there was a permanent blockage, a natural migration barrier on the main stem up until, when was it, Craig, 1950-something?
53, Larry.
So they wouldn't have been able to get up there until that blockage was unblocked. As far as why we're finding them up there now, there's probably a couple of things going on, one of which is that while there have been surveys in this watershed over time, they haven't been... they've been conducted in different ways using different protocols. Some years were spawning surveys, some years were snorkel surveys, some years were electrofishing, not always in the same place. So we don't really have a very kind of comprehensive data set over time or in space. So it's possible that they could have been there for a while and no one had really seen them just based on, you know, the kind of infrequency of sampling or the lack of kind of comprehensive surveys over the entirety of the watershed. I think it's much too early to say anything about their recovery. That's why we're really, and it's an encouraging sign for sure, that in such a bad year for coho, I mean, by all accounts, the returns for this year were down 70%. It was a horrible year for coho. So it's really exciting that we saw them there. It's a really an optimistic sign. But I think we need to do some more in-depth study to really get at what's happening with the populations, both spawner surveys and juvenile out-migrant trapping, to say anything conclusive.
I'm particularly interested, since I've been around the Garcia a long time, and I think Craig Bell can remember when Fish and Game was doing weird trapping at the mouth in 76 when the Gualala closed up, but some of those fish went over and went up the Garcia. This is really encouraging. This is cool stuff.
Thank you. I can see where he's squealing underwater.
Jonathan asked me if it would be the pleasure of the board to hear anything about the emerging air quality issue and how forests are playing a role in reducing greenhouse gases. And the Garcias at the forefront of that effort, it will probably change the way forests are managed, but it seems a bit out of context for today's meeting, but Jonathan wanted me to offer that if you're interested.
Well, I think it is important to mention it's a new feature, and I think anything we can do to help highlight the potential and that's being done. But we'll wait for another day for more full.
Thank you very much.
And I would just ask, in terms of, you mentioned the settlement, the PVM, I'm not sure if that name's right. What's the total dollars put into this?
I want to say $608,000. And it's with Pulte Homes, and it's an EPA supplemental environmental project. Clean water, stormwater.
So just some former EPA people involved in that probably along the way. All right. The chair is going to advise we're going to take a 5-minute break. Start up the next panel at 11 o'clock.
I have two credit cards all total, but only one for item number 7. This is good. The card is hard to clear, but I like that for item number 8.
It's not there. You touch it and you get center to pay up. So you can't even really listen.
But I'm going to turn it back to the case of the Thank you. Miles of roads within the ownership that needed to be dealt with, and included in that 123 miles of road was a lot of issues like this one. It's a fish migration barrier.
So
the ownership, the owners realized they had a lot of work to do and were proactive in their planning. So they set up a management plan to deal with a lot of this, and one of the first methods was implementing a watershed analysis program. That's basically our monitoring and comprehensive analysis of the watershed that's similar to what the Conservation Fund is doing in their EMAP program. We have a lot of similar programs, monitoring programs wrapped into this whole watershed analysis program. Everything is available on our website, and included in the program is our road inventory monitoring, which I think is probably the most relative component when you talk about TMDLs and sediment loads. We also do lots of habitat monitoring for fisheries, geology, and birds and other terrestrial species, and also the stream channels.
So,
the road inventory monitoring is, like I said, a component of watershed analysis, and this is a map printout of our holdings in the Garcia River. And you really can't see anything up there. I know it's kind of doesn't make a lot of sense, but basically that's all of our road systems in the Garcia, and all those little colored dots and triangles and squares are culverts, crossings, and landings. So since 1998, we spent a lot of time GPSing all these points, all our roads, and we have a pretty good handle on what's out there. The next step is assessing the costs and time of fixing a lot of these sites. And we have everything ranked. It's just a matter of going out there and spending the time to see how much it's going to cost. So in 2005, we took the option two of coming up with our own erosion control plan and site-specific management plan. And this outline of the erosion control plan is just like everybody else's. And it basically, we use a lot of the information from the watershed analysis program and feed it into this erosion control plan so that our foresters can look at these maps of unstable areas, mass wasting areas, our road inventory maps, our fisheries maps, and it helps them to write their erosion control plans. We also developed the site-specific management plan, which has a lot of the standard language in it. And at the same time we were working on this, we were also working on our habitat conservation plan. So we worked really hard to make those two fit together. And even though our habitat conservation plan isn't completed yet, we're hoping that it will be soon. And we can operate under the larger umbrella of that habitat conservation plan, and it'll fit with everything in the TMDL. And this is the fun stuff that I like to talk about. The restoration work started from day one in the Garcia, and we controlled approximately 45,000 cubic yards of sediment since 1998, decommissioned almost 7 miles of road, and we worked on two large watershed-wide projects with Pacific Watershed Associates, one in 1998 and one in 2007. Kind of the hot zone of issues in biology is the South Fork Garcia, and we've done a lot of work as far as restoration and monitoring in that area. As you can see up there, we've almost half of the sediment we controlled has been in South Fork Garcia, 2.3 miles of road decommissioned. Done a lot of work with various nonprofits doing in-stream habitat structures. And that culvert you saw at the beginning of the presentation, we've removed that and put in a bridge. And so we have fish passage there now. And in doing so, have some highlights from our fisheries department. And it's basically cove salmon have been detected in the South Fork Garcia River for four consecutive years, 2005, 2006, 2007, and 2008. This is the first time all three cohorts of coho salmon have been observed in South Fork Garcia, and we're pretty proud of that. Here's a map of our of our distribution sampling locations for sound logs. We utilize the electrofishing method. We don't do snorkel surveys. We have done those in the past. There's some discussion of doing some out-migrant trapping in the area, but we haven't done anything about that yet. We also do temperature monitoring, so we're kind of following everyone else's footsteps in that realm. And that's pretty much it. If you have any questions, fire away.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Mr. Bell.
Chairman Anderson, members of the board, it's a pleasure to be here again. I always appreciate having any interaction with the Regional Water Quality Control Board staff.
Oh, he said any interaction.
Well, it's easy for me to say, not being a landowner in the watershed. Yeah. I'll start out while that program comes up. I want to point out that everything that's happened in the Garcia, in my opinion, started out with a filing of a non-concurrence on a THP on coastal forest lands property, I believe in 1988. That spurred the landowner, the owner of coastal forest lands, to agree to participate in the formation of a watershed advisory group and to develop a watershed plan for the Garcia River, which is one of the firsts of the Garcia River. I'm going to mention the number of firsts that the Garcia River is, the number of firsts that have occurred on the Garcia River in California. That is one of them. But a single filing of a non-concurrence on a THP started the Watershed Advisory Group, which met for about a year and a half to develop a watershed enhancement plan, which was adopted by the Mendocino County Board of Supervisors in 1991. So I can say that it's always been a pleasure to work with your staff. Work that was done by Holly Lundborg was tremendous early on in helping guide the technical side of those things. The work by Alita Mengelsdorf in the actual TMDL, which was miraculous that you could use an advisory panel to develop a regulatory process with all stakeholders at the table. As you know, that is seldom accomplished. Alita Mengelsdorf and her and support staff here at the Water Board, we owe a great deal of gratitude for them for that very difficult task. After that was finished, I stepped up to the plate to become a watershed coordinator. My background is as a logger. I worked primarily on Louisiana Pacific property, commercial fisherman, steelhead fishing guide on the Garcia for 24 years now, and I later became when I recognized how serious the problems were, I immersed myself in an education of understanding watershed analysis, watershed planning, watershed restoration. I served on the board of the Santa Monica Restoration Federation for 15 to 17 years and served as its president, as did Dave Hope, one of your staff members. I have an amazing education in all of those fields, but I am not a fluvial geomorphologist or a biologist, but I can converse freely with those folks. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to start talking about building cooperations to solve sediment problems. We're going to start in the estuary. I'm going to move up through the watershed. That's a picture of the Garcia estuary. At one time, it was probably 30 feet deep. I got involved in this back in the 80s with Leonard Craig, who you heard mention was born in 1909. I used to sit out in the watershed with him and have him tell me stories about how they would spear salmon in the 30-foot deep Garcia estuary. Those pools now are 12 foot deep. But I can say, and I forgot the jar of sediment, of substrate material, when a dozen years ago when I was guiding anglers in Lower Garcia, it was so muddy that I had to be very careful at aiding them crossing the estuary where you could in the shallow portions because the mud would suck your boots off. I went down there about 5 years ago, started walking across, and I was walking on gravel. So I ended up crossing five different places. The entire estuary now is covered in gravel rather than mud. And I feel that is due to the natural recovery, reduction of logging, improvement of logging practices, and the TMDL, Comprehensive Restoration of South Fork Garcia, which is nearly completed, and just general awareness of landowners. So all those factors have led me to make the astounding discovery that the Garcia estuary is now lined with gravel rather than mud, and even the spawning gravels in each riffle are so much improved that I'm astounded. And that's a actual memory that I can record of having drifted that river hundreds and hundreds of times. So that's the estuary. That's it. It summer flows. During the winter, when the river gets up 18 feet, 30,000 CFS, that whole picture would be brown water. So it can be an active system. Okay, key elements for recovery. I was taught this. These are like the pillars of recovery. You need cooperators, planning, education, training, regulatory framework, restoration, monitoring, acquisition of key habitats. We're firing on all cylinders in the Garcia. I used to give this talk before we had the acquisition of key habitats. Education training. There's Mr. Bob Clamp. I wrote a grant for the city of Point Arena when I recognized that we could create some local jobs, and we trained. We helped the financial aid we gave allowed the San Juan Restoration Federation to create its first ever field school. I think they're now on 20 something. We trained 46 people for 4 weeks. I ended up employing 11 of those people in full-time living wage jobs, carrying out restoration projects in the Garcia. There's Bob Clamp teaching McNeil's sample. Planning, we've got lots of planning documents. There's more than this. Enhancement plan, 1992, the gravel management plan, estuary study. I was a subcontractor in that to Trush and McBain, along with Steve Pignata, who's now a DFG biologist, and Patrick Higgins. We have limiting factors assessment. I have our estuary study twice. Evaluation of Garcia River restoration. I've written two of those, 05 and 07. We have a Chris Garcia document that's amazing. We have a site you can go to. It's pretty much a dump site for everything that's ever been developed in the Garcia, and I have tried to help update that. And the Conservation Fund developed their integrated watershed management plan. Cooperators, lots of those. Regulatory framework, you're at the heart of that. You're out in the lead. Like it or not, the water agency staff, in my opinion, have for quite a number of years been out at the front, taking the heat and making progress site specifically and watershed wide in a number of the coastal watersheds. Okay, here we are in the estuary. We did the estuary study. Heavy concentrations of cows in riparian zones could cause damage. It's pretty obvious. And here's a site. This is repair. That's that site, 2005. Henry Stornetta, who's a local landowner down there, he had the courage. He's 70-some years old. He had the courage to step up to one of our Garcia watershed meetings one time and say, "I'm 70 years old. I'm here to say that we got to get these cows out of the water, out of the stream. They're eating up all the vegetation, trampling the banks. The river's eating our land." It changed everything. His simple act of doing that started the whole restoration in the Lower Garcia. I approached him after the meeting. I said, "Henry, if you will fence your cattle out, I will get the money and the volunteers to fix your banks." Larry Starnett's site. This was March 1995. The Mendocino Resource Conservation District, with some funds that came from an AT&T drilling mud spill, provided matching funds for a grant that was written to, I don't know if this was EQIP or DFG, but this was a bioengineer project, and it was the first project carried out in the Garcia, and it was carried out by Evan Engberg, who is the leading proponent of bioengineering techniques in California, and it's right at the limit of the capabilities of that. That's 1995. Same reach. That is now an engine of steelhead production, juveniles. That's Larry Starnett, a very happy guy. He's had hundreds and hundreds of people come on his land and plant trees, AmeriCorps folks being the core of those volunteers, but also local fishermen, local environmentalists, high school students, grade school students. We have at times arrived at his property with Greyhound buses of volunteers. Okay, here's the Garcia River at the Highway 1 Bridge, February 94. I see pulses of sediment come through the system. I literally can track them almost, but you can see still heavy amounts of sediments and relatively fine, although they were finer before I started taking these pictures. 2003, you can see obviously slightly different time of year, but the coarsening of the sediments. This was 2008, coarsening of the sediments, closing in of the vegetation. You can see the vegetation on the top actually overhang the whole stream, and that's due to work by Walt Starnetta. I have to single out Walt Starnetta. He is a person who I am frustrated. I've never been able to get him a single dime of public aid for a number of reasons. I have been able to provide him trees. He's a very proud man. He's a very self-reliant man, very successful dairy owner, and he has used his own money to get to provide match for dealing with waste management, which he's done a very good job. His fields are organic, certified organic, and he, of all the people that have worked, he really has done every bit of the work on his land, which is from here downstream until you get to Larry's himself. No public help. Here's just upstream of the Highway 1 bridge. This is, you can see the bridge abutments back there. This is on Henry Starnetta's property. And there's the former mayor of Point Arena, Jeff Kabing. There's none other than Alan Levine right there. And there's local fishermen there, fishing clients of mine. I'm there. There were some students there. We were willow spriggling. It has to be the best bang for the buck, by far the most efficient method of restoring habitat restoration that's ever existed, in my opinion. Just those stakes, 3-foot-long stakes, driving those in, that looks like, oh, that's no big deal. That's just kind of feel-good work. Same site. Okay, the riparian zones on private dairy farms where sediment sources impose risk of valuable ag land. This is Henry Starnetta, the fellow who started it all, really in terms of the landowners agreeing to recognize that cattle grazing too close to the streams were a problem on the Garcia, and stood up and with some courage and stated that. This was that site in 1994. This is literally looking up from the Highway 1 bridge. There's Henry Starnetta's ranch. If you drive over the Highway 1 bridge and look upstream, you can see this site. That's 394 before we did intensive bioengineering fixes of that. Primarily with volunteers, we only spent $5,000. This project did not cost Henry Starnetta a dime. Same site. There's Henry. He's a proud guy. He's a colorful guy. When I first met him, he just had every kind of reputation you could imagine. I mean, there's stories about Henry Starnetta. Stogie's his nickname. He died 2 years ago. He is one of the most colorful characters in the whole area. Talked about all the fish he harvested in the good old days. He made bank restoration. It literally became like his religion, his passion. When I arrived with volunteers, he would have been out there from daylight. When we leave, I'd drive by in the evening to go someplace else. He'd be out there at dark. I'd see his blue jeep out there. He loved planting trees. He loved working with the young volunteers. That's Henry with AmeriCorps volunteers. Here's the Kendall Ranch. It makes me very emotional, actually, to talk about Henry. The Kendall Ranch in the year 2000, you probably are aware of this if you've been around long enough. Vern Kendall was a nice enough guy. He was a very old gentleman by the time I met him, almost in his 80s. He didn't understand riparian function. He didn't understand hydrology. He allowed his sheep to eat all the riparian vegetation. The sheep ran freely down to the river. They ate all the vegetation, high flows, started eating his land. He wanted to use heavy equipment to solve the problem and didn't understand what all this bioengineering talk was. I worked for the Mendocino Resource Conservation District as a volunteer. I helped get grant money to fix this project when it was this long, from here to here. We could not get a permit from the Army Corps of Engineers. The project went from this long to this long, and next year to this long to this long. I'd go down there with tour after tour of agency officials. We had every permit except for 404. Couldn't get it, so the budget for the project obviously didn't grow. And this became a major problem. Vern told me, he says, before I'm gonna, I die, I'm gonna solve this problem. So one time in February, I came home from a meeting late at night on a full moon. I saw the river kind of looking purple as I crossed the highway and bridge. It struck me as odd. The next morning, my phone started ringing saying, Vern Kendall's gone wild with bulldozers and he's rearranged the river. He did. He took bulldozers and moved the river over, built gravel bars, gravel dams, earth dams, berms. When I came down and saw it, I knew he was in big trouble. And the first storm would happen, I said, the river's just going to run straight through all your work. But he said he'd do it before he died. I think he died a month later. And his relatives were stuck up with a cleanup and abatement for your department from DFG. They didn't have the funds to do it correctly. They did some measures that were okay, some of which you can see remnants of here. But really, there wasn't too many to do it right. So Mike Bohr, who is an RCD director who I worked very well with, bought this ranch. I called him up and said, Mike, let's fix this right. He says, whatever you want to do, Craig. He said, I'll provide match. I'll fence out cattle. I'll pay for the pumping. So I went to work with Evan Ingber. I became the project manager for Bioengineering Associates, wrote the grant. Evan and I wrote the grant. I was the project manager. We got money from 319H, Department of Fish and Game, and we went to work. I had the idea of trying to turn this project into a training site for Salmon Restoration Federation. Jonathan Warmerdam showed up as one of our members, and they learned not only bioengineering techniques to salt banks, but also in-stream structure faceting techniques. And by the way, bioengineering, the techniques we're talking about here that fix Henry's property and Larry's property, these techniques are over 2,000 years old. The Chinese, back when they were an agrarian society, used them to tame the Yangtze River and create recapture soil and to build soil gardening areas. It involves the minimum use of rock and heavy equipment, the maximum use of living materials, primarily willows. So that's the site. That's an aerial view of that site. You can see that is not habitat for anything. That is a water heating area. There's no bird habitat, no animal habitat. And plus, Vern was losing land. That project originally was here. Every year, the river kept taking land. It would still be going if we had not worked on it. Here's the site from the ground level. Same thing. You can look at that and see. He's just losing pasture. Okay, so here's the site looking downstream. Same reach. 2007. I think that's 2007 photo. Trenches were dug. Jonathan showed that. Rock. Those were 12-foot long willow sections that were laced in there. Put in about 8 foot deep with only about 4 feet above, backfilled with rocks. And now that's extremely complex habitat. It's holding adults and juveniles and a myriad of other species, and it survived very high flows. Same reach looking upstream. 2,000-year-old techniques being used in California. Here's one of my fishing clients who caught that's about 14, 15 pound adult female steelhead, which was caught on a pool created by a wing deflector on the lower side of that project. I've been catching fish there every year since the completion of the project. Pre-project, that water was 12 inches deep under the same flow conditions. There's four of those pools in this region. Moving upstream, here's the Galliani property. Obviously, you can see same problem. There were sheep grazing, no fencing. The river used to be over here, started marching through their land. Here's Evan Ingber. California is probably the West Coast leading proponent of bioengineering. Here's one of his members, pre-project 1996. Same reach 2003. Now, these things are so tall, and there's actually alder trees almost at that height all the way through the project. Moving upstream, the Beebe Ranch. I have a drift boat guide. I got my friends with drift boats to come over two or three times a year with AmeriCorps volunteers, local fishermen, school children. We got trees donated from Mendocino Railroad Company, Louisiana Pacific Company before them. We packed the drift boats full of trees and kids. We float down anytime we found a gap in the riparian. We dump out kids. They plant. I pick them up down below. We float down until we find a gap. We probably planted, I think between the willows and the alders, probably 40,000 trees. This was a day with primarily AmeriCorps kids. We actually did some fishing. I used to catch a fish during our floats back when you could harvest a fish, and that was dinner for the evening. Okay, this is, I said I wouldn't do any charts and graphs. why are we here? This is why the TMDL happened. Here's estimated background levels. Here's man-induced sediment levels. Thus the TMDL, thus the listing of the Garcia. I used to see things like this when I flipped down in the 80s, especially gravel bars with layers and layers of pollution, sediment, sand. I don't see those anymore. I don't see any of those anymore. This same reach now has cobble and gravel. The cobble is probably the smallest size. It's probably golf ball size, and the biggest is probably softball size in the same exact site. I'm sorry I couldn't find the photo of after, but I can take anybody there who wants to go.
Where is that?
This is right above the Kendall Ranch.
Sediment.
Well, who knows where it's from? It's from all over. Okay, how does this happen? How about 4 to 6 miles of road per square mile and harvest that occurred? These are not old. This is not 1950s and 60s harvesting. This is 80s harvesting. What does that lead to? Road failures. Improperly managed water straight to the water course, 100% concentration. Here's the stream. Olson Gulch. 85-95. What does that lead to? Mouth of Olson Gulch, 1995. Soil pollution leading right into the Garcia, filling holes, polluting spawning gravels. There was restoration done up there by Jack Monschke. Some of that stuff also flushed through. Nature has a great capacity if you shut off the supply, or if she moves the supply out to solve these things. 95. Same site. Gravel, vegetation. The roads contribute to fine sediments, crossing failures, culvert installations. Kurt wasn't there at the time, but Russ was. You mentioned the South Fork Garcia. That was the beginning. I was hired to do strategic planning for Trout Unlimited and identified a number of major sub-basins, coho refugia sub-basins in Mendocino County to be targeted for their North Coast Coho project. And we recognized that coho were such a low level that we needed to, on an emergency basis, identify refugias, go in, comprehensively assess them by Pacific Watershed Associates, train the equipment operators to correctly carry out road upgrades and decommissioning, and implement them. Our pilot project was South Fork Garcia. That's in stage 3 now. I think there might be only one site left. It might end up being the first one delisted. Because the goal of the TMDL is not to list the sub-watersheds, it's to delist them, as we need to always think. But that's Steve Trafton. He was the project leader for Trout Unlimited, and I was a kind of architect strategic planner. That project now is in about 8 watersheds. That's on phase 5 of Hollow Tree Creek, also on Mendocino River Company land. I can't say enough good things about Mendocino River Company. They've given us everything we asked for. And that project probably has saved key refugious coho populations that will then serve wild populations that will then serve to repopulate not only other sub-basins, whole watersheds up and down the coast. Here's Danny Hagan, Pacific Watershed Associates, up on a landing up in Fleming Creek. And the interesting story about this is I helped build this landing, I think, about 1981 when I was a logger. And it was a landing that, at the time when we built it, we knew it wasn't right. There was a Y shape. There were 2 culverts with a Y joint in them underneath this landing. And the Jimbo logger boss I worked for, he didn't have a good feeling about it, but he was told to go ahead with it. When Pacific Watershed Associates did the assessment, this was on a road that had been pretty much abandoned. And this had about 5,000, maybe 6,000 yards of gravel or of dirt. The level of the landing was at the level where Danny's hands are. And the angle is deceiving. Actually, in some places, it was above the height of the arm there. And so we chose to open this road back up and go up and excavate out this landing. And for me to go to be paid to take apart a landing that I built in 81 is an interesting turn of events. So that's now been excavated out. That was replanted. We worked with a number of crossings. Here's a crossing we pulled in there. There's me and my dog standing there. That's a properly pulled crossing. Down to gray bedrock material at a proper angle of repose, large wood set aside. This is the same site. There's my dog after repairing, planting, and recovery, maybe only 3 years later, functioning cleanly. Okay, so we have some amazing things happened to the Garcia. Mendocino Redwood Company came in, bought up this middle section of the river. We got the pilot project, the TU North Coast Cove project, which has now moved all the way to the coast. I've actually been hired by Trout Unlimited to do strategic planning. We're taking the same model that started on South Fort Garcia, another first, all the way up to Southern Oregon. And key refugia watersheds on the way. Conservation Forest came in for just the center part, the heart of the Garcia, the heart, the North Fork, half of Blue Water Hole, one third, Inman Signal. We have that, Myard Ranch, TMDL plan, Bronzolino, non-industrial timber management plan, Bartolow. We are in a position to see the Garcia comprehensively restored, maybe in another lifetime. And I'm already seeing amazing changes in the quality of spawning gravels. When I used to float the main stem Garcia, I used to see 7 to 8 reds per mile, or in the hole over 8 miles. The past 2 years, last year I saw almost 100. 2 or 3 years before that I saw 50. Main stem Garcia above Blue Water Hole, repairing and planting. We have a chance to recover main stem rearing on the Garcia. The temperatures are really, really high. They didn't used to be high. Here's main stem temperatures above coho level, but not too far from steel at comfort level. How do we know it? Shapovalov, 1948, saw steelhead and silver salmon a mile above that site. Now those are lethal temperatures, but we're turning it back in the right direction. Main stem Garcia down by Oz, Hooper's property. Look at this. We're solidly in coho and steelhead habitat, and steelhead are using this for their whole life cycle. Reemergence of a whole life lower mainstem spawning population of steelhead, spawning there by choice, rearing successfully by choice. Not that far above coho, at coho levels in some years, and coho have been found down there. All our work upstream will continue to lower that lower temperature until it gets into coho rearing and possibly even coho spawning range. And my interest in this, you're looking at one of the wildest things that can be produced by nature, and that's also a big fish. I'm a guy, I've had epic battles with fish like this. That's a 40-inch wild steelhead, probably 6 to 7 years old, probably 22 pounds, caught and released. I've had battles with fish like that have lasted 40 minutes, and you have no idea how powerful those animals are. Okay, that's it, and the work that's going on at Signal Creek and Inman Creek, the same approach that I prodded the Conservation Fund into doing that was done on the South Fork, hiring Pacific Watershed Associates, starting with Inman Creek, Signal Creek. They're doing comprehensive upslope erosion control followed by in-stream structure replacement. That's going on. I've been somewhat impatient with the Conservation Fund because I felt I knew what needed to be done, and I, to their credit, they listened to me and went forward on Inman and Signal Creek along with their own staff in agreement and quick analysis before their management plan was done. And I think it was. I'm happy that's done. I hope to work with them to guide their in-stream structure program, which I sense they need some guidance, and I'm hoping to continue to work with them on that because I have some ideas how that should proceed. But we have turned the corner of this river. I predict this will be the first river of 100 square miles or less comprehensively restored in the Garcia River. And I'm seeing Chinook salmon back, which I didn't see a dozen years ago. I'm seeing them every year, spawning right in this reach right here, right in that Kendall project that we did, Chinook salmon, in the past 3 years. So there's some amazing things going on, and I've worked on it since the 80s. Maybe I'm carrying the mantle for Leonard Craig, but it's very important work. I don't make a lot of money doing this. I'm probably at poverty level wages or income for the past 4 years, but somehow my life is intertwined with this river. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Board member question? What's your sense in terms of looking forward? I mean, given a good report on things that have happened in the past, or do you, on the one hand, the momentum is building, lots going on the other hand, there is no money. So.
No, there's money. The Garcia River Forest, it's a working forest. I have to commend them. They would not have had to go as fast as they've done. Did I tell them to slow down? No. But the fact that just before they've cut a stick of timber, they're putting out matching funds to hire Pacific Watershed Associates to do their roads, the entire Inman Creek and Signal Creek, and now the entire rest of the North Fork and their entire holdings. There's an assessment going on. I'm working on some in-street portions of that. The cost of that is very, very high. The fact that they've put up this money before they have cut timber or with a very low timber income is unbelievably commendable. If I would purchase that property, I would have gone much slower. But they are a conservation organization, and so I guess that's a high enough value. There's going to be money. I sit on the statewide team that that decides where money gets spent for restoration, about 19 million a year, the DFG pot. That's going to continue. You guys have money. The Garcia is going to continue to attract money. Why? Because they've set aside conservation reserve areas, 300-foot no-cut buffers. Inman Creek is an entire conservation reserve. The Garcia has a TMDL. We're better to spend your money than a watershed where the investor is assured that the watershed literally has a warranty that that watershed will continue to move comprehensively towards dealing with the sediment sources. And so few landowners. And Mendocino Redwood Company is marching forward. The only thing I fear about are catastrophic floods or earthquake. Those are the only dangers that I fear. There will be nothing that will stop recovery moving forward short of those.
All right. Thank you. I have one speaker card. Alan.
Hi, my name's Alan Levine, and I live in Point Arena, and I represent Coast Action Group. And it's a complicated problem. You saw all that's gone on, all that needed to fall in place to make the Garcia turn around. The Garcia was a hammered watershed. You saw pictures of the people at work. Also, in conjunction with Craig, I started in 1990. There was Friends of the Garcia, which I was a member, and John Hooper, Peter Dobbins, former member of the regional board, Leslie Dahlhoff, and her husband, many, many other people in the Garcia watershed that cared and put a lot of energy into restoration projects and put a lot of energy into pushing the idea of improvements on the Garcia. And what I want to do is sort of frame the picture in a certain kind of way with you, because I want you to realize what has to fall in place if you want to see this type of improvement in other watersheds. And I'm sort of going to go through the history real quickly with some other interpretations. The Garcia is a simple watershed. Most of the land use impacts are from timber. Other watersheds that you're dealing with have more agricultural impacts and more water diversion impacts. The Garcia doesn't have water diversion, so it was simpler to deal with this from the TMDL point of view. And that made it easier to have a success there. And you have more complicated TMDLs that you're dealing with, and that's presenting the regional board with more difficulties in solving the problem. I started working with Craig in 1990 on the comprehensive restoration plan that was precipitated by work from the regional board. Craig mentioned the non-concurrence. Mark Neely here was working on the Garcia back then. Was it Mark Green and Frank Richmuth? And there was litigation from Susan Brad Holly, who now does historic law for buildings and putting historic buildings into a safe harbor. She gave up on environmental law. And that started the program of investing research and coming up with the enhancement plan, which was approved in 1992. After the enhancement plan, well, it was, you saw the pictures. The Garcia had undergone two huge waves of very intense logging. The second wave between 86 and 98, I just want to give you a couple of statistics. They mentioned 6 miles per square mile of road, but there was really 26 miles per square mile of disturbance, counting the skid trails. You saw how much disturbance was there. It's a steep watershed. You take 26 miles and you divide it up into square mile. You can frame the whole square mile and then put a road every 150 feet. 150 feet isn't far, so you walk 150 feet of road, another 150 feet of road for a mile. That's what you got. You have that much disturbance, you're going to end up with a lot of sediment in the stream. And also, you're going to end up with warm water. This all happened under then the current forest practice rules, which have undergone some change. The T&I rules are working better, and CDF is somewhat more educated in what needs to occur, and they're paying more deference to impaired water bodies and TMDLs. Also, in the coastal forest lands, 24,000 acres that was purchased by the conservation fund, that the occupancy of merchantable timber was taken down to 4,500 board feet per acre, where Mendocino County average at the time, and still is about 12,000 board feet per acre. Pre-logging inventories were in excess of 100,000 board feet per acre. That's 95% of the timber conifer basal area gone. So you can see like there's a big difference in what the vegetation was like in the area that the Garcia Fund purchased, and why you had the sediment impacts you had. So after 92, we were lucky. The Garcia River has been very lucky. AT&T did a major goof up there, and they had to come up with some funds to make it better. So they funded our initial restoration plans to get things going. In 95, the TMDL litigation occurred. Coast Action Group sponsored that. It was backed by PCFFA and other environmental groups. We got a consent decree, which was the first watershed to undergo a TMDL, Garcia River. It was the best TMDL you did. It's sort of outdated now, but it has enforceable language. And the point I'm getting to is TMDLs are there to give somebody a kick in the butt to go in the right direction to fix things. And that's what happened in the Garcia. People were moving. Some people were unhappy. Larry was unhappy. We went to a TMDL meeting and Larry was there, and they were actually talking about taking me out and stringing me up. And it happened more than once. And I'm not joking, it was serious. They were pissed. Larry and I get along now. He sees the benefit. He says, well, you got $12 million worth of my trees. I just argued with him about that. Well, under the Corp Forest Practice rules currently, the threatened and impaired rules, you couldn't take those trees anyway. So did the TMDL take them, or did the forest practice rules take them? He said, well, the TMDL came first. So, you know, that's just kind of a little joke between us. 2002, the TMDL was approved, and it isn't just the TMDL that made the turn into Garcia. It was everything all put together. But the TMDL with enforceable language helped. And I'm a little bit discouraged by the Shasta and Scott TMDLs. I don't think that they hit the mark of really getting people to move, and I think you're having some frustration and difficulty there. Finally, the ultimate result is that you see what the Garcia River looks like. You see fish in the river, and that's what we're here for. And I'm glad it makes Larry happy, and I'm glad it makes a lot of other people happy. I also want to say that working with your staff has been great. And I have my difficulties with them sometimes, too. I don't always get what I want when I bring up issues and subjects, but I respect their opinion, and sometimes we differ in different areas. But all in all, they are doing triage, trying to do the best that they can do, and I hope that you're cognizant of that fact. I'm finished. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Great. Can I make a brief comment about the coho?
Yep. Just because you pled poverty before.
Okay. Well, that's absolutely true, so it's okay. Anyhow, about the finding of coho, yes, we haven't done, there hasn't been a lot of population surveying for whatever reason. I've always had a bias towards action projects, not monitoring, and assuming that we're doing the right things, but I'm happy. The Nature Conservancy, their program is
really, really comprehensive. I resisted initially. I thought they should repeat other sites from Monitor. I think it was it's a wonderfully scientific-driven plan. Jen Kara has been tireless in having to be a strong learning curve as a botanist coming in to do these things. Happy to always work with her. It's a great plan that will produce trend data. I have every confidence, which will be very good for supporting future TMDLs. But it's concerning the finding of coho. I have to caution young biologists and people who get into this field. The total number of those coho that were observed are barely enough to produce another pair of adults. So when you see 10 coho or 15 coho or 20 coho, it's very good. It shows presence. It shows presence in a sub-basin that triggers you should do more intensive in-stream structure work, habitat work, but it doesn't really show recovery. It's presence, absence. So until you show me 100 coho or 1,000 coho, I'm really not going to get enthused because really a small number is barely enough to replace their parents and probably in a lot of cases not enough to replace the fish that laid those eggs. So I have to dampen the enthusiasm about coho. On steelhead, amazing things are happening on steelhead in the Garcia.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Board. Comments, questions, staff? Final comments? Certainly appreciate everybody coming and appreciate all the work that's being done out there and in the sense that it's an upbeat assessment at this point. That's a good thing. Go forth and do more good. Thank you.